Friends of the Congo's DRC Women, Peace and Security Center in Kinshasa, and WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Freedom. My name is M1. I'm half of the legendary Tell It Like It Is, Everything Is Political rap duo Dead Prez. And this is WPFW, Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
This is a journey.
I got so much trouble on my mind. Refuse to lose. Here's your ticket.
He is amazing.
I didn't know nothing about it.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Say what you say, say what?
I don't want to be like Mike.
Before Magic's knees go permanently south for the winter.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Changing up the guard quicker than fear brings down doo-doo.
With the finger roll, what's the foul?
Hey, young bro.
He never saw Elgin Baylor play during his day or Oscar Robertson.
Flash the dice roll back. The big O was jackknifing through all them bodies.
I didn't know nothing about it.
Where sports and politics collide, here at your home for jazz and justice on WPFW in Washington, D.C., and also airing on WBAI in New York City. It's Chuck Modiano, your host for today. The bad news is we are missing Dave Zirin, who won't be with us. We're missing Etan Thomas, who won't be with us. But we have good news in their place, where we have Julie DeCaro coming in. Julie has been on the show before, Peabody Award-winning journalist, author of Sideline, Sports Culture, and Being a Woman in America, and author of the Daily Sports and Politics Newsletter, Losing My I'm butchering it again, and I just have my perspicacity. Hey, Julie, help me out. Say that for me.
Perspicacity.
Now I got it. Julie, appreciate having you here. We got a great lineup today. We're going to talk about the big news that has happened this week in the NFL. Robert Saleh is fired. I'm going to interrogate you about a tweet that you made that I agree with. Why was he fired? There are multiple theories going out there. And we're also going to get into the WNBA playoffs. What's been happening this playoff, maybe a little preview of our finals, and then talk about the season that has been this almost revolutionary season. Where, you know, Caitlin Clark has taken center stage. There have been some good things about that, and there have been some bad things about that. And we're going to get into that in media a little bit. And also what's going on in the news, we have the Major League Baseball annual crapshoot. The Mets yesterday advanced, and now out of five teams, they are the fifth team who is a lower seed to advance. And this seems to happen every year. This weekend, take a peek. We got the Commanders versus Ravens. Magic Mike asked me, you know, who do I have? I have the Ravens on that one. So all this is happening. We still have a genocide that is going on. And that might be the lead-in to where we're going, because we want to talk about Robert Saleh. And I'm going to sort of put out the three theories. And I've done my own research, and Julie has her opinions. But there are three theories. And one theory goes like this. The Jets stink. He hasn't done well enough as a coach, so he was fired. The first time owner Woody Johnson fired a coach midseason in his 25 years. That's one theory that I'm seeing on social media. A second theory is He's bumping heads with Aaron Rodgers, which Aaron Rodgers vehemently denies. Aaron Rodgers has said, as far as any of the ridiculous allegations out there, I resent any of those accusations because they are patently false. It's interesting the amount of power that people think I have, which I don't. I love Robert. That is Aaron Rodgers' response to that theory. And then there's a third theory. And that third theory is that Robert Saleh put on a Lebanon patch at a time where Lebanon is being bombed by Israel with U.S.-backed weapons. And in doing so, that prompted Woody Johnson to make a move that he has never made before. I lean towards that opinion. And this is the part, and I could get into that, but this is the part where I'm going to talk to you, Julie, because I saw the tweet that you had, or something on Threads to that effect. And then you got mobbed so badly that you said, you know, maybe I'm going to take down this tweet. The mob was coming after you. Go ahead.
I just didn't have it in me that day in particular. Yeah. Sometimes it's easier just to delete than it is to, like, you know, try to fight everyone off. But yeah, I mean, go ahead. I mean, that's, I said, I think it's interesting that this happened right after he wore the Lebanon patch, and that, you know, Woody Johnson is a guy who served in the Trump administration as an ambassador to the United Kingdom. Woody Johnson is a huge Trump stan. When Trump won the primary in South Carolina, he was standing right behind him as a supporter. You know, obviously Trump has an infamously tight relationship with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And yes, Robert Saleh has worn the patch before, but not when things had escalated to the degree that they have now between Israel and Lebanon.
Well, I think that last point you said is key, because people are saying, well, last year they had a heritage month in October and everyone wore a patch of their heritage. It blew by me. I didn't even know this was happening, but it didn't have meaning because at that time, you know, Lebanon wasn't being bombed. So when that was part of a league-wide initiative. When he reintroduces the patch this year, he does that on his own while Lebanon is being bombed by Israel with U.S.-backed weapons. So I think that makes like all the difference in the world to that critique about last year. Is that your take as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably a factor of all three things, right? I mean, I think that if the Jets are, you know, 5-0 or whatever, that you know, Robert Saleh is probably still a coach. I think if Aaron Rodgers doesn't make a big scene out of how much he hates his coach by shoving him away when he tries to hug him on national TV, maybe he's still there. But I think that the reason it happened after that game, I mean, it might have happened at the end of the season, but I think the reason it happened that game, I think the reason it happened when it did is because they're in London. It's a huge international stage. And, you know, that game, Robert Saleh decided to wear the Lebanese patch, which I thought was a very courageous thing for him to do. And I admired it greatly. Woody Johnson, I'm guessing, had a different take. And not only that, you know, Woody Johnson was an ambassador to the United Kingdom. All his friends are watching, I'm sure. And, you know, here comes his coach wearing a patch of, you know, the wrong side, for lack of a better term. So, yeah, I you know, Woody Johnson is, like I said, he's a Trump guy. I mean, I don't doubt that he heard from Trump. The other thing is that he, you know, he and Aaron Rodgers talked Monday night before Saleh was fired on Tuesday. And then Rodgers is insisting that they didn't talk about Robert Saleh, and then he gets fired the next day. Give me a break, Aaron. I mean, I know he thinks everyone's stupid, but no one's that stupid.
No, I mean, you're absolutely right. And I think the key part that you mentioned is that he was ambassador to the UK and they're in London. There is, he's a political figure. He's not just an owner. He's a political figure. He was the ambassador to the UK, and he's visited Israel and met Netanyahu in previous trips as well. You know, so this is someone who's already involved in politics before we get to anything. But I want to do some. I'm going to filibuster a little bit, Julie, because, you know, last night I was doing a little bit of research, and I want to debunk maybe the argument that I keep getting on Twitter, very similar to the Cap sucks argument, and that's why Kaepernick is no longer in the league because he can't play football. This crowd is inundating me, and you were probably being inundated too, that he sucks. So, but let's be clear that it's not for football reasons alone. So Woody Johnson takes over the Jets in the year 2000. And in that time, He does not fire a single coach midseason. And not only midseason, it is so rare that any coach is fired in the first half of the season. Normally you get to complete the first half of the season. I only found like six coaches. I might be missing a couple of years, but I would look from 2000 to 2020. And I had only found six coaches at that time who were even fired before the end of the half. That's how rare that is. So, and when that happened, like Jay Gruden is the only one who had five games, and he was 0-5. And the others were generally people that who were either 0-4 or 1-3. And in each, almost all of those cases, they had a bye coming up. So they had a bye the fifth week. The owner was thinking about making this change. Their defense and offense were terrible, and they probably rushed it up so they could give the new person 2 weeks, the new coach 2 weeks to move forward. So Lane Kiffin was 1-3, bump heads with Al Davis. Scott Linehan was 0-4 and a bye. And you could go on and on. Ken Wisenhunt was 1-6 after a 2-14 season and 3-20 record. So you have a body of work. That is not Robert Saleh. Robert Saleh is not that. He went 7-10 the last 2 years, took a rebuild project from 2-14, went got four wins with a rookie quarterback, thrown into the fire. And let's be clear what he did. He turned the defense around. Right now they have the number five defense. None of those other early firings, none of them have any type of a top defense. They were garbage on both sides of the ball, usually at the bottom of the NFL rank. And then let's look at his quarterbacks. He went 7-10 two seasons with Zach Wilson, Mike White, Joe Flacco, Trevor Siemian, and people not in the league, and Tim Boyle. So with backup quarterbacks, he went 7-10. You will have no history of anyone being fired 2-3 or even 2-4 or anyone who's one game above 500. So that is the history of the NFL. And then if you take, I told you I was going to filibuster, Julie. And then if you, before I get it, I got to get this out. And then if you take the Jets themselves and Woody Johnson, he had six different coaches go 4-12 or 4-13. And in every single case, he let them ride out the season. This isn't George Steinbrenner, the famous owner of the Yankees, who was impulsive and could fire you in a minute. He was the anti-Steinbrenner. And to cap that off, in 2020, Adam Gase started the season 0-13. And in that 13th game, they lost by 40-3. And then what did Woody Johnson do? He said, you know what, Adam Gase, I think you've done enough to finish out the season. And that is the context behind Saleh being fired. It doesn't make any football sense if we have no geopolitical knowledge, if we have no idea what's going on and their professors and people are getting fired right and left for speaking out against Israel interests. If you knew none of that, on football reasons alone, you cannot say this man was fired for football reasons. There's no data and there's no statistics that support it. Filibuster ended.
Chuck, nobody dives into the research like you do, my friend. I completely agree. I think that there's a couple things happening. I mean, number one is also that, you know, none of those times did he have Aaron Rodgers at quarterback and all the expectations that come along with that. You know, people last year, people thought the Jets were going to win the Super Bowl. This year, people think the Jets are going to win the Super Bowl. So I'm sure there is pressure from that. But one of the things I think is really telling is that when Adam Gase, who is a truly terrible coach, and I say that because he was an offensive coordinator for the Bears, and we saw how south Adam Gase was going long before anyone at the Jets did.
And you're a Chicago person, for people who don't know. You're a Chicago
person. Yeah, I'm in Chicago. Adam Gase was the Bears offensive coordinator. He was brilliant for like a season and then just absolute garbage after that. And then he somehow got the Jets head coaching job. But he, you know, he was terrible. He was also a really weird guy. He apparently his wife had a C-section, and immediately after they were stitching her up from the pregnancy or from, you know, giving birth, he was like, okay, is it okay if I go back to practice? Like, just complete weirdo. And then all the weird, you can go online and watch all these weird faces he makes at press conferences and everything. Anyway, that guy gets fired and is not escorted out of the building by security the way Robert Saleh was. Now, I know that a lot of employers are starting to do this. I think it's so horrible and craven, and just, you know, to have security walk someone out as if this person who is part of your organization is now going to like steal everything on the way out or lob an IED on the way out or something. I mean, it's just, it's ridiculous. But, you know, that to me spoke volumes. There's zero reason to have Robert Saleh escorted out by security. I just don't know what the thinking behind that is. I mean, he's been your head coach. He was your head coach when you woke up in the morning. Like, have a little respect for the guy. And to me, that just spoke volumes of, you know, you've crossed a line. You are no longer in Woody Johnson's good graces. We're going to have someone watch you to make sure you don't do anything on the way out while we escort you to the parking lot. And to me, that complete and total lack of respect was said more than just about anything else.
Right. Saleh going to steal a laptop on the way out.
I mean, right. He's going to take a playbook and give it to the 49ers. I mean, I don't know.
That's right. And to my understanding, he started the day. I mean, he started the day as coach. So, you know, if you wanted to make a decision Sunday night before he walks in, you know, you can do something like that. So it seems to me that he made a pretty impulsive decision on that Monday with some pressure.
Well, he hadn't talked to Aaron Rodgers yet.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that is the other theory. So, I mean, let me pose that, because I'm going to rule out the football theory. There's no evidence for it. So Aaron Rodgers, he pushed him. Aaron Rodgers vehemently denies it. That's the other theory. Do you think there's any legs to that?
I mean, look, you know, the rumor has it that Saleh was talking about getting rid of Nathaniel Hackett, who, since he left Green Bay, has been a complete disaster. I mean, his tenure with the Broncos was absolutely, I mean, it was comical to watch the football decisions this guy made. They bring him to the Jets to lure Aaron Rodgers there, or to, you know, to, because Aaron wants him there. I can't remember if Rodgers or Hackett came first. But either way, I mean, that's Aaron's guy. Hackett has always been Aaron's guy. And, you know, the offense has been pretty miserable. I think they're averaging something like a little over 18 points a game. And you've got the quote unquote, you know, greatest quarterback who ever lived, who, you know, is not able to hit his receivers. So the talk was that Saleh was considering taking away play calling from Nathaniel Hackett or replacing Hackett altogether. You know, and I'm sure Aaron had plenty to say about that. You know, we did the article last year, and I wish I could remember who wrote it and where I read it, about the outsized influence that Aaron Rodgers has in that building. I mean, he missed mandatory minicamp this year because he wanted to go to Egypt on an ayahuasca trip. I mean, so, you know, obviously Aaron has a lot of sway within the halls of that organization. And, you know, you're talking about getting rid of his guy. And that's why I think I didn't have anything to do with this. How can people even think that? Well, Aaron, because, you know, wherever you go, coaches who you don't agree with either tend to lose power or get fired. I mean, we saw it in Green Bay with, you know, he didn't get along with Matt LaFleur. We've seen it, you know, in other places. He got Mike McCarthy fired because they were knocking heads. Aaron gets what Aaron wants. And so it's hard to imagine that Woody Johnson, A, wouldn't have consulted Rodgers about this, and that B, if Aaron had made a case for why Saleh needs to stay, that Johnson wouldn't have honored that.
Yeah, I think you're, I mean, to me, that's the only other plausible explanation, because, you know, at the end of the day, you know, in 3 years, he did turn around the defense, right? And that is important. Yeah. You know, number four defense 3 years ago, and then the number five defense right now. And there are really, there are arguably a couple of plays. They lost one game by a point, another by six, a couple of plays away from 4-1. So, like, if you have the defense set, it's easier to have that set than, you know, maybe, you know, make the adjustments and fix the offense, that this kid could potentially be a playoff team because the defense is there. And again, there's no history of firing coaches who have the number five defense in the league. So Aaron Rodgers' part could also play a role. It could be. I don't think there's any, you know, football argument to be made. I will also, you know, say, if you're looking around what's going on around the country, it is also consistent with firings. There are more of Finkelstein, a Jewish professor who is tenured, and tenured professor is supposed to be an area that's untouchable in all of employment. And she was recently fired for liking an Instagram post, and she teaches about the Middle East and Palestine. So this is a Jewish professor in a university with tenure. She got fired, and there's a long list that's been happening the last few months. And then if that can happen, you're going to tell me that can happen to a coach who you don't need any reason to fire someone who is on a contract, and coaches get fired all the time. So, you know, it brings to light so many people who are getting fired, particularly in academia and in other places, you know, for showing any type of solidarity with Palestinians or opposing the Israeli policy. So I'm going to lean there, but I'm not going to dismiss the Aaron Rodgers factor, that might be part of it.
Yeah, like I said, I think it's probably a combination. How much, you know, of the record, how much of, you know, Saleh is Aaron Rodgers, you know, butting heads plays into it. I don't know, but I stand by. I don't think if Saleh doesn't wear the Lebanese patch on you know, the London game on international TV, he's probably still the head coach.
Yep. I think that's the bottom line here. He's probably still the head coach. I'm sorry you had to deal with all that abuse, but it's funny because I thought of you right away when I had to take the tweet down the mob, and part of me was like, no, Julie, forget the mob. Don't let them do that to you. Because I was getting a mob.
I have PTSD from Twitter. So as soon as I catch a whiff of that stuff, I'm like, all right, I'm out.
I know. And in fairness, when the mob comes after a woman, they come out after a woman differently than they come after a man. That's very clear if you've been in these spaces. So let's, you know, the other reason I really, really wanted you on is because, you know, you've been following the women's sports, you've been following the WNBA for years, and we're in the middle of this momentous season, let's just say. And I want to get to the season and the media and Caitlin Angel and all of that stuff, but I really want to start where we are right now, because we're about to start these finals that are, I guess you could say, drama-free. So the Aces, who are looking for a three-peat, get upset. Well, you can't even say upset. They lose to the Liberty, who were in the finals last year. In my opinion, had just had too much size up front and had the rebounding advantage. Aja can't do it alone, and you have that. So they go to the finals. But what's interesting also is the Minnesota Lynx, and I think on some level it's the coming out party of Nafisa Collier, because she'd been overlooked with all of the Caitlin news, with Aja having arguably the greatest season in WNBA history. And any other season, you'd say, wow, you know, you watch her and she has no flaws. She does nothing wrong. She rebounds. She passes. She scores. She hustles. She plays defense. She does everything. And I'm kind of excited about this matchup from, you know, the world getting to see who she is. And what are your thoughts about the finals moving forward?
Wow. I mean, I'm pretty excited for these finals. I'm also grateful that they appear to be relatively drama free so far, at least. We have that. You know, the thing too, though, about the drama is that we get that from men all the time. You know, I mean, we watch the NBA finals are in the NBA playoffs are such a great time on social media, in part because everybody knows the beefs. Everybody knows who hates who. Everybody knows, you know, who can't stand this guy or who said what about so-and-so on their podcast. And that's kind of what makes it fun. And, you know, we've got all these memes floating around and everything. So I always say, you know, the NBA finals are the greatest time to be on social media because they're just pure fun. And it's as much as I can remember what it was like to be on Twitter in the beginning before like the dark times came.
Yeah.
But I feel that same way sort of about this. I mean, I was surprised at the Aces going down. I mean, especially in the way that Minnesota just sort of flicked them off. I'm sorry, the Liberty sort of flicked them off. Wait a minute. It's early in the morning. I'm getting completely confused. Anyway, they went down so quickly. It wasn't a blowout, but it was less than what we expected from the Aces.
Yeah.
Nafisa Callender has been amazing all season. You know, the Lynx were long shots coming into this season. I don't think anyone expected to see them in the finals. They haven't been there since 2017, even though they had a great run before that. So certainly, you know, they're sort of, I guess, kind of always in the mix, but we thought maybe not this year. But they've been impressive. And so it's going to be, you know, Nafisa Collier versus Breonna Stewart. And I would add Jonquil Jones in there as well. Jonquil Jones and Nafisa Collier versus Sabrina Ionescu and Breonna Stewart. That's a matchup that I would like to see. And, you know, it's Minnesota has the best record. Liberty have best record for the season, but Minnesota has the best record since the Olympic break. It's going to be great. I'm sort of going back and forth on, you know, who we think has the upper hand here. It kind of depends on what day you ask me.
Right. And also depends on what day and how well Minnesota is shooting. I'm taking the Liberty in four games. And the reason I'm taking the Liberty is for the same reason I think they beat Aces, is that they have size advantage. You know, Jonquil Jones, former MVP, is 6'6". Breonna Stewart, a former MVP, is 6'4", and they have size. And no one told Nafisa Collier she's only 6'1". She did not get that memo the way she plays. But I think over a long series, that is going to take its toll, just that size advantage. And when I looked at this, the season stats, and Minnesota beat Liberty twice, the only team to beat Liberty twice, 2-1, but they shot 50% from three in both games. And that's just not a sustainable thing. So if they shoot very well from three, and they're the best three-pointing shooting team in the WNBA, shot 38% as a team. So in other words, as a team, they shot 38%. Caitlin Clark, who's known to be a great three-point shooter, shot 34%. So their whole team shot better than Caitlin Clark, and they're going to have to shoot above 40 and in the 40s, I believe, to overcome the rebounding advantage and the size advantage. So that's my prediction, Liberty in four.
Well, I also think, you know, one of the things about the Lynx is that the only rough patch they really had this season is when Nafisa Collier was suffering with fascia plantaritis. So, you know, she carries that team on her back. And how well she plays, I think, is going to go, you know, a long way towards how the Lynx do in this series. That seems like an obvious thing to say. But, you know, I mean, like you said, we've got in New York, we've got Jonquil Jones, we've got Breonna Stewart, we've got Sabrina Ionescu. Like, the Lynx are very, it's much more spread out in the Liberty. So I guess we could say, you know, their roster is a little bit deeper, but I never count Cheryl Reeve out. I cheer for the Lynx because I wrote a story a couple years ago about what they had gone through with the Minneapolis head of the police union sort of taking shots at them and walking out because of the way that they had taken a stand in the summer of 2020 for Breonna Taylor's life and, you know, all these other things that had happened, and they were very outspoken. And so they sort of went to war with the head of the police union there, Bob Kroll, who was by all accounts just a terrible person. So, I mean, I always sort of cheer for them, even though we've got the Sky here in Chicago. I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, I feel like they're surging right now. The Liberty look ridiculously tough. But, you know, the Lynx feel like they're sort of having a moment right now and they're sort of hitting their stride. So it's going to be interesting.
It will be interesting. But I have to pause you because you did talk about how the Lynx, you know, took that stand. I want you to elaborate on that because you did cover that. And the WNBA, if you really look at the leagues who've taken the stands in the greatest intensity and solidarity against police terror over the years, it's been the WNBA. I mean, even the Fever itself, Tamika Catchings organized everyone as a team when they kneeled years ago. And they were the only team in full, all players, to kneel. So could you talk a little bit maybe more about the Lynx role?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, obviously in Minnesota, we had not only George Floyd, but also preceding that was the Philando Castile murder by a police officer. So I think Minnesota in particular had, felt very close to this issue. And obviously the women on the team did as well. You know, Bob Kroll was the head of the police union there. He was typical head of a police union. I mean, the guy that we've had in Chicago has been pretty terrible as well. They tend to be the people that are really over the top with their rhetoric, with the way they talk about police brutality, things like that. And Bob Kroll was no exception. He sort of ruled the cops in Minneapolis with an iron fist. And the Minneapolis police had been providing security for Lynx games, as a lot of cops, you know, get overtime providing private security. The Lynx, you know, had taken a stand that summer. They had worn, I think what preceded this, they had done several things, but I think what preceded this incident was them wearing the I Can't Breathe shirts that were sort of floating around that summer. And they wore them during warmups, I believe. And that was a bridge too far for Bob Kroll, who is not going to tolerate any suggestion at all that, you know, the police were at fault in any of these situations. So he pulled police security. And, you know, he pulled them from the Lynx games. And so, you know, they were like, well, the police were not going to provide security for the Lynx games anymore. And, you know, Cheryl Reeve and the players stood up to him and didn't back down and basically doubled down on, you know, what they had been saying about the way that the police were treating people. And it was, I thought, a pretty inspiring moment. And so I got to talk to Cheryl Reeve about that, you know, a couple years later. Bob Kroll, thankfully, is now out. He retired some time ago. But, you know, there was quite a bit that summer of 2020, there was quite a bit of pieces, and there are quite a bit of pieces in the press floating around about Bob Kroll and exactly how he ruled Minneapolis and sort of, you know, the kinds of things he encouraged the police to do and refused to apologize for. And he got a lot of heat. And I give a huge portion of the credit to that to Cheryl Reeve and the Lynx for, you know, refusing to back down and to speak what the truth to power. And even, you know, at the time, the WNBA was nowhere near as powerful as it is right now. And so I thought that was an incredibly brave thing that they did.
I think it was incredibly brave. And, you know, I appreciate you bringing that back. And, you know, for those unfamiliar of how bad Minnesota was, you know, we all know what Derek Chauvin did. But to me, the story of Derek Chauvin is that he was also a field training officer, that Derek Chauvin, you know, taught other officers of the proper way to do policing. And not only that, you had the three officers who were protecting Derek Chauvin. And not only that, the DA, Mike Freeman, refused to file charges until there was an uprising. So you had a whole rotten system. And I think the original report was that George Floyd died of medical injuries, nothing about a knee. So this is a rotten system that protected Chauvin at the beginning until the people stood up. So, hey, Mike, are we taking a break or are we rolling through? Okay, so I'll tell you what, like, hit the break and we're going to come back and we're going to talk a little about the WNBA season, the impact of Caitlin Clark, and what's ahead, and try to put this in perspective.
Used to cop a lot, but never cop no drop. Hold mics like ponytails tight and bobble ops. Stop, stick around, come through and dig the sound of the fly brown 6060 cycle. Who throws itching around? Bound to go 3-plat. Came to destroy rap. It's an intricate plot of a b-boy strap. Ed Smith cats get kidnapped. Then release a statement to the press. Let the rest know who did that. Metal fist terrorist, claim responsibility. Broken household name usually set in hostility. What is MF? Silly, I like to take men's to the end for 2 milli. Do-do-do-do-do, that's the audio daily double. Rappers need to fall off just to save me the trouble. Yo, watch your own back, him in and go out alone, black. Stay in the zone, turn H2O to cognac. On doomsday, ever since the womb till I'm back where my brother went, that's what my tumor say. Right above my government, Dumoulin. Either unmarked or engraved, hey, who's to say? I wrote this one in BCDCO section. If you don't believe me, go get bagged and checked in. Cell number 17, I'm under the top bunk. I say this not to be mean, was bad luck, a pop junk. Pop the trunk on Seaside.
Appreciate you, Mike. Let's talk WNBA this season. It was such an interesting season with media. Caitlin Clark enters the league. Attendance goes through the roof. Ratings go through the roof. You can arguably say almost the majority of fans came via Caitlin Clark. And that is a double-edged sword there, because on one level, I do enjoy watching her, particularly her passing. And I think when she realizes that she's a great passer, like in the second half, and plays that role, I think she's at her best. I don't think she's at her best when she's jacking up threes, shoot only 34%, taking logo threes, when she could kick it to Kelsey Mitchell, who could shoot 40%. So when she plays to her strength, which she did in the second half, she does very, very well. I like watching her. And yet at the same time, it's almost impossible to try to enjoy her, because she brings, for lack of a better word, a mob with her that is coming. People who never watched the WNBA before, often they're often men who are from the Barstool crowd or Outkick variety. Now they're weighing in for the first time and have no knowledge and are disrespectful to all the black women in the league. And that media comes with it. So it becomes so hard to just, you know, enjoy her play, because you're constantly having to push back on these negative forces. Like, can you appreciate Caitlin without denigrating Angel Reese or denigrating Aja Wilson and this whole dynamic? So for me, it's a mixed bag. And I want to make one distinction before turning it over to you, Julie, is that I'm sure, like, there are a number of Caitlin fans who are new to the WNBA who would have come if Caitlin had been black, if Caitlin was Juju Watkins. I'm sure that exists and there's a section. But there's a huge section who did not come to the WNBA for Caitlin's greatness. They came for the WNBA for Caitlin's whiteness. And it is very clear when they exchange with you that that's the reasoning. On some level, I feel like they're almost poisoning this discourse. And that's generally the struggle that I've had. And you've written a lot about this. You've talked a lot about this. What are your general thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's right, Chuck. It's been difficult. First of all, to look at, you know, the masses that have come for Caitlin Clark and been like, okay, so why wasn't it for Candace Parker or for Breonna Stewart or for Sabrina Ionescu? I mean, certainly I remember, you know, Sabrina Ionescu's jersey selling out when she first got drafted, things like that. But you know, Caitlin Clark is not the first great player we've ever seen in women's basketball.
Right.
It's not like this is Cheryl Miller. You know, I don't understand what's different. I mean, it's that it's Iowa, that you know, the team was largely white, that I really don't understand it. So
by the way, yes to what you just said, but continue.
Yeah, I mean, that's something to me has been like when these people are like, and even you hear people like Stephen A. Smith or, you know, some of the guys in the NBA talk about Caitlin Clark as if she's the greatest player who's ever graced the NBA. Maybe she will be, but she's not yet.
Right.
And she certainly improved tremendously throughout the course of the season. But, you know, I thought what Diana Taurasi said at the beginning of the season was right, that, you know, she's going to get knocked on her butt a bunch of times. And she's, you know, she's been playing with 18-year-olds, and now she's going to play with women in their 30s who have been in the WNBA for a decade. And that is going to be a huge adjustment period. And that's exactly what happened. And, you know, I looked at, you know, the way Clark went down in a lot of games, and I saw exactly what the league had done, the women in the league had done to Candace Parker her rookie year.
Yeah.
And Breonna Stewart, her rookie year, you know, that this is just sort of what happens. It's the welcome to the NFL, kid, you know, meme that we always see. And for some reason, that to be taken and twisted into this sort of racial war of the NBA, to me, was so disheartening and upsetting. And you're absolutely right about this new group of fans. I mean, you clearly, they don't know who Cheryl Swoops is from the way they talk about her.
Right.
Like, you can tell, you have no idea who Cheryl Swoops is. Like, they don't know the history of the WNBA. They don't know who the great players are. I mean, they don't know anything about the league. They're looking at the Olympic roster and screaming about Caitlin Clark not being on it. Like, who on that roster are you going to take off?
Exactly.
You know, who doesn't deserve to be there so that Caitlin Clark can go? And, I found the whole thing really sort of disheartening and disgusting. And honestly, it sort of put a pall over the whole season for me. You know, a season that we all should be celebrating, that these women are finally getting their due and finally getting the eyeballs that they deserve and have always deserved. But, you know, for it to come with this, like, as Caitlin Clark is a proxy for a race war, has just been really sort of upsetting. And honestly, you know, I was relieved when the Fever season was over, because I was like, wait, we're going to have a couple days of, oh, I can't believe Caitlin Clark's not in the playoffs. And then, you know, it got bounced from the playoffs, and then it's going to be over. And we can focus actually on basketball. And so that's where we are now. And that finally feels good.
I had the exact same reaction as you, Julie. When they were bounced, it wasn't that Caitlin, it's that I didn't have to deal with this mob, that all these people who are saying at any cost you should be happy for ratings. Well, go away. Those who want to stay, then I welcome you. But those who are going to go away, stay away. Now we can actually, maybe for the first time in the next 10 years or so, because I imagine Fever, they have a strong squad, are going to be advancing, we can have real basketball discussions. And I'm going to enjoy these finals for real basketball discussions without the noise. And you mentioned a few things, and I think I want to touch on two of them, because I think people get wrong. And one is Taurasi, and the second is the Olympic team piece. And so let's talk about Diana Taurasi. And this is why I knew we were in trouble. I mean, I just knew we were in trouble. Diana Taurasi said, just like you said, she said nothing wrong. Not only that, she was prompted by Scott Van Pelt with a question and was referred to Camila Cardosa as well. And how would the rookies deal with it? And she said, not just reality is coming. It has been reduced to that quote, reality is coming. And she was correct, by the way. But not only that, she said, we all went through it. This is part of the learning curve. And, you know, somehow they cut out those parts. And then the mob went after Diana Taurasi. Now, let's put this in perspective. Diana Taurasi is a leading sports, the leading scorer in WNBA history. We're talking about some royalty, has a gazillion championships when you count six Olympics, when you count what she did overseas in the EuroLeague and Russia. Wherever she goes, she wins three WNBA championships, three at UConn. This is arguably the greatest winner of all time, you know, Sue Bird may be right there, but even more than Bill Russell, if you're counting what she's doing overseas. And she's white. And when you put all of that together, and they went after Taurasi in a way that I couldn't believe, that I thought was terribly unfair. And not only that, but like when you looked at the all-star voting, and I'm trying to put a metric to this, but when you looked at the all-star voting, Taurasi just on her history is usually like in the top five, top 10. Mm-hmm. This year she was kicked out of the top 25. And then you saw all the Indiana Fever players get the votes. And then you saw Kate Martin, her Iowa teammate, ranked like number 10 or 11. And it was, they punished Taurasi. They elevated Indiana Fever players and Kate Martin. And that this mob that follows her is an industry. I mean, it's a cash cow. Yeah. And if Diana Taurasi, of all people, could be punished, how does anyone else stand a chance? How does a black woman player in the WNBA with less of a pedigree stand a chance? And before the season started, I said, uh-oh, this is different here. This is something different. This is not just a regular fan base.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I will admit, Chuck, that I am one of the Kate Martin stands. I thought her it's such a great story, you know, that she went to the draft to support Caitlin Clark. She winds up getting drafted, and then she winds up on, you know, the Aces and this amazing team, and their strategy of hazing her as a rookie was just to love her as much as possible, as publicly as possible, which was so great. And I think it was so emblematic of the way that women bond on sports teams, you know? Yeah. And so I thought that was a great story, but you're exactly right. I mean, I looked at how many votes Caitlin Clark was getting and other people were getting versus some of the NBA, you know, the OG all-stars. And I couldn't believe it.
I mean, no, that's right. And listen, I like Kate Martin too. But I think we could agree she's not the 10th best player in the WNBA,
correct.
Right?
Correct.
So, you know, sometimes, and then I notice anytime I ever critique Caitlin, it was hate. So Taurasi has said she's a hater. And anytime I have a legitimate critique, and I have two critiques. First of all, I could talk for days about her passing. I think right now Caitlin Clark is the best passer in the WNBA and will become her court and become the best ever. And her court vision is ridiculous. And I love when she is in that zone. But she right now she has two flaws. She does turn the ball over too much. She shattered the WNBA record, 5.6 turnovers a game. I believe that will go down with familiarity as you move in and keep playing. So that should come down, and I get that. But it was a flaw, and it would be my biggest reason of leaving her off an Olympic team as well, because you're playing with players you never played before. You have a high turnover rate. I don't want you playing with new players with a high turnover rate on basketball reasons alone. And then the other part is that I feel her image of the logo 3 is harming her. We saw that in the playoffs. In the second half of the season, she is playing fantastic. And then by the time you get to the playoffs, she went back to the Caitlin who's jacking threes and these logo threes. Well, and she's marketed as the next Steph. Well, you know what? Before Steph was shooting 43% from three, we called those dumb shots. We all called them dumb shots. But Steph somehow could hit that logo three at over a 40% rate. And we said, okay, you get it. At the beginning, it was like, what are you doing? And then it went in. The problem with Caitlin Clark is those logo threes aren't going in at a high rate. If that changes, she's not in the top 25 in three-point shooting percentage. If that changes, then I'll remove this statement. But she has, when she drives and she kicks it out and she has like a 56% two-point percentage, when she does that, she's at her best. But when she falls in love with the three, it falls back. And you can't make these critiques because it is only said you're hating. And you can't make any critique. And that's the problem I have with all of the Caitlin Clark discourse. You're not allowed to critique.
Right. And you're not allowed to cover her the way you would cover someone else. You know, I mean, we saw it with Dejanay Carrington, like it's, you know, you poked her in the eye on purpose. And, you know, we saw, oh, she got completely clotheslined by, you know, Alyssa Thomas and, you know, all this stuff that happened early in the season. So what? That's what happens to rookies. You know, I mean, when it happens in the NFL or the NBA, we're like, welcome to the NFL. But when it happens to their perfect princess, now it's a problem, and it's racial. And I thought that was so damaging. Women, you know, look, I played soccer and volleyball my entire life. Soccer, women's high school soccer is as tough a sport as there is. I mean, we used to grab each other's, we used to tape our ponytails, tape our braids to the back of our neck so that people couldn't grab it and yank it when the ref wasn't looking. Women don't need to be protected, especially from other women, by men. Yeah. So that whole thing to me was just insane. Like, this is, you know, women are not allowed in society to be as aggressive, to be as competitive, to be as angry sometimes as we are. And we take that out on each other on, you know, on a field or on a court. And the fact that men were somehow now stepping into this conversation and saying, you can't, you're not allowed to do that to her. You can't touch her that way. Look at what this is what we do to each other. Women are no less competitive than men. And, you know, when you're playing sports, your emotions get the best of you sometimes. Sometimes you're a little rougher. Sometimes you're just not in control of your body and you accidentally hit something harder, someone harder than you meant to. But to suddenly make it this, like, you know, oh, they're all after Caitlin Clark was just, you know, it was shocking to me that the WNBA didn't see this coming, because we saw it at the draft. We saw it during the Final Four, the way people were reacting to Angel Reese versus Caitlin Clark. And so the fact that, you know, Kathy Engelbert and the league wasn't prepared for this, to me, is the most disappointing thing of the whole season.
Well, you said so much there. And so I have a follow-up question, because you're really getting into the race gender dynamic that has been going on, because the white men entered the chat, and not just white men, but the men entered the chat for the first time. I'm talking about the men who's never watched the WNBA. Yeah. And even if it was a white male player in the NBA who was fouled hard, they wouldn't have this almost instinctive protective reaction. And yet, when Caitlin was fouled hard, as other players were, I saw Angel Reese get clotheslined by Alyssa Thomas, pulled down harder than any foul on Caitlin, and there was crickets. And then you get a foul on Caitlin, and we're seeing the Chicago Tribune saying, this is assault. You're seeing people lose their minds. And I think you said Princess. A lot of the men, and it was male-driven, were having this protective reaction to Caitlin foul that they wouldn't have with white men, and they certainly wouldn't have with black women.
Right.
And that was deep. So could you just go farther into that? Because that was really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, what do you say about that? I mean, I think it's a very conservative point of view. I mean, we hear people like Donald Trump talk about, you know, women need me to protect them. I want to be the protector of women. We saw J.D. Vance saying that women need to trust Republicans to make their decisions for them. You know, I mean, we don't need that. a lot of us who are, you know, feminists found our feminism through sports and the outlet that sports gave us. Women are, you know, pretty tough. We, you know, and like I said, especially with each other, if you grew up playing sports, you as a woman, you know exactly what I'm talking about. We don't need men to jump in the chat and, you know, start telling us like, you know, oh, you hit her too hard or you did this too hard. Like, we don't need that. Like, we are competitive, sentient beings all on our own. So I think it does come from a very conservative place that, you know, women need men to protect them. But yeah, I mean, the racial aspect of it is impossible to ignore, right? I mean, when it happens to Angel Reese, they cheer when it happened, because now somehow this black woman is getting what she deserves. Whereas if it happens to a white woman, it's, you know, oh, you're against her because of her race. And, you know, this whole thing about reverse racism. And, you know, and I've looked on Twitter, when I see people saying these things, I click on their bios and it's all MAGA stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I feel like Caitlin Clark has become just another, like, proxy in the political war. Now, this is where I have to remind myself that Caitlin Clark is 22 years old and didn't ask for this.
Yeah.
Because I've been disappointed when she has spoken about this. She has, you know, said, you know, if you feel this way, you're no fan of mine. You know, she said that, you know, she stuck up for Dejanay Carrington a little bit when she said, you know, oh, of course she didn't do it on purpose. I admire that, but I wish that she didn't have to be asked to say this. I wish that it wasn't coming after the games and the, you know, the post-game press conferences. Like, I felt for a while like she needed to say something publicly, and I wish she would. And I know Nancy Armour wrote this for USA Today too. Like, she needs to say something to these people, because when you have people showing up at Indiana Fever games with a shirt that says ban nails and, you know, these huge fake nails on.
Yeah.
Like, that was a direct shot at black women and their culture. Yep. the, you know, and then to hear Brittany Griner and, you know, other players talk about what it's like to play the Fever and the racial slurs that you hear. And I mean, and look at the way that the same crowd reacted to Brittany Griner being held in Russia. I mean, a gender nonconforming, you know, queer woman who's also Black, they thought she got what she deserved. So I mean, these people, they're deplorable, to quote Hillary. They're the worst of the worst. And if I were Caitlin Clark, I would be really concerned that this was the, you know, at least a significant segment of my fan base. And I do feel bad for a lot of little girls in Iowa who, you know, watched her play in college and maybe in high school and are getting to see her play in the WNBA. And in that sense, it's bringing a whole new generation of young white women, I think, to the WNBA, which is amazing and great. And that's what we want. But to have this other component come along with it has been just so upsetting and devastating.
Yeah, first of all, I appreciate everything you just nailed. And Aja Wilson, in an interview recently, she said, yeah, we like the extra ratings, but at what cost? At what cost?
Yeah.
And at sometimes, no, the cost is not worth it. Take some of your ratings back. We'll keep half of it. Take the other half back and go and be gone. That's how I feel about it, because what every Black player, Black women player is saying, they're dealing with abuse. Even yep. Black sports writers and sports figures, someone I mess with on Twitter, Sabrina Whitaker, who's been covering it, she's like, I've never received incredible abuse. Even when I post and it has nothing to do with Caitlin, they'll say, why aren't you talking about Caitlin? How come you didn't talk about Caitlin here? And there's a dynamic is that, and here's what I noticed. If you're an Angel Reese fan, I'm a huge Angel Reese fan, and she is already probably the best rebounder in WNBA history, shattered the record 13 a game and like close to 15 in the last month and a half. She'll probably shatter that again next year. Why can't we appreciate seeing a Dennis Rodman in the WNBA for what she does? But if you talk to Angel Reese fans, I think you're going to say, yeah, Caitlin is a good player. And they'll say she's a good player. And no one's going to deny that. But if you talk to this mob, they'll say Angel Reese stinks. She's garbage. She can't shoot that well. So why do you have to denigrate the Black woman to uplift Caitlin? And this is the fundamental problem I have with dealing with this mob.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, we love Angel Reese here in Chicago. Love Camila Cardoso. Love Kennedy Carter. I mean, that's our team. We love Teresa Witherspoon. And I think
don't get me started.
Yeah, we were sorry to see her go. Yeah, I mean, it's really been upsetting. I mean, I thought that, you know, like I said, the seeds of this were sown. We could see this coming back during the Final Four. And that game, you know, this is a generational rookie class that came into the WNBA this year. We're going to be talking about these players forever. These are going to be the next Cheryl Swoops and Lisa Leslie's and, you know, Diana Taurasi's. Like, this is that class. They're going to be incredible. But this has been rough. And you can see it when the players are asked about Caitlin Clark with the kind of just the sigh and the eye of the roll. And I don't think it's for Caitlin Clark herself. I think it's for the whole circus that comes with her.
Yeah.
And like bringing all these people to the WNBA is great. I still am trying to figure out, like I said, why Caitlin Clark? Why didn't this happen with Sue Bird? Why didn't this happen with, you know, Swin Cash? Like anybody who had these, you know, great college years and that, you know, and then went to the WNBA. Like I think that in a lot of ways, I mean, I'm not going to say that Caitlin Clark isn't a generational talent. She may be. She probably is. You know, she certainly looks to be headed on that trajectory. But, you know, to be able, how often do we say that, you know, some guy coming out of college should rule the NBA? We don't. Because we know that there's a learning curve there. And that just hasn't been acceptable to talk about with Caitlin Clark. And like I said, you know, I try to remind myself that she's 22 years old and that she's probably being told just to keep her mouth shut by her people so she doesn't alienate, you know, brand deals and things like that. Yeah. But, you know, I do feel like she sort of owes it to her colleagues to say something to these people.
That's right. I think that because the mob is so out of control, I would love to see her say some previous remarks, but come out stronger. Because I'll be honest, I don't know if anyone else could stop it. It's like a runaway train, and she may be the only one who could stop it. So I'm at a necessity. Because the other part, besides the Caitlin social media mob, what we have is also the mainstream media, corporate media, sees a cash cow.
Yep.
And they're going to create controversy. So you brought up Stephen A. Smith. One of the things that like made my blood boil, it's a very little comment. Stephen A. Smith likes to say comments for controversy. We understand you start a debate. I remember a few years ago, he said, Donovan Mitchell's the best Utah Jazz player ever. And I'm like, well, you ever hear about Stockton and Malone? But when he said that, and it was clear he was trying to hype the Jazz in the playoffs, he was roundly criticized. Like, come on, this is ridiculous. Da, 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 da. But when he says, okay, when he says, you know what, Caitlin Clark should be in the conversation for MVP when Aja Wilson just had the best history ever, her fan base believes that. They don't mock it and they back it. So that's the problem I have. So where can people find you, Julie?
You can find me on Threads or Instagram at Julie DeCaro, and you can check out my newsletter at Losing My Perspicacity. It's a Simpsons quote. You can Google it. It's a daily newsletter where we talk about sports with a feminist lens.
Thank you so much for your perspective, Julie. Really appreciate it. I look forward to having you back soon. And you have a great one. And
thanks, Chuck.
Definitely. And for everybody else, we'll see you soon. I think Atan and DZ will be back next week. And look forward to it.
You see, I come from Mississippi. I was young and running wild. Ended up in New York City, where I had my first child. I named the boy Nasir. All the boys call him Nas. I told him as a youngster, he'll be the greatest man alive.
School is back. Do you need an after-school program for your young one? The Words Beats and Life Academy is enrolling for students from third grade up to young adults, with programming weekdays, 3:30 to 6 p.m., offering classes in hip-hop performing and visual arts, as well as business and arts leadership, with access to professional teaching artists, equipment, and resources. Located in Columbia Heights, Northwest Washington, D.C. at St. Stephen's Church. Classes are always free. Enrollment at wblinc.org/academy, based on availability. The fall session begins September 9th. We hope to see you or your young one there at the Words, Beats, and Life After School Academy.
All right, all right.
Remember, wblinc.org/academy.
Indigenous peoples are frequently referred to as a prime example of resilience and resistance, charting the course for a new way of being, decolonized, anti-imperialistic, and communal. On Monday, October 14th, Indigenous Peoples Day, from 9 a.m. until 7 p.m. through both music and public affairs programming, we explore what it means to be Indigenous and celebrate Indigenous cultures from around the world. That's Unpacking Indigeneity, Monday, October 14th, 9 a.m. until 7 p.m. on WPFW, Building a Better World, one broadcast at a time.
Friends of the Congo and WPFW invite you to Love Sound, an evening of Soul Sisters in Performance on Sunday, October 20th from 5 to 8 p.m. at Westminster Presbyterian Church, 400 I Street, Southwest, Washington, D.C. The evening features performances by musicians and poets including Navasha Dea, Laini Mataka, Maimuna Youssef, and Sweet Honey in the Rock. Details, including a complete list of performers at WPFW.org or friendsofthecongo.org. All proceeds benefit Friends of the Congo's DRC Women, Peace and Security Center in Kinshasa, and WPFW, Building a Better World, one broadcast at a time.
Fall is a time of change and impermanence. What never changes is WPFW's unwavering commitment to providing reliable news, informative public affairs, and exceptional music that inspires both action and introspection. From October 14th through November 3rd, we celebrate The Circle Unbroken, 47 years of being in the community with WPFW during our Fall Pledge Drive.
We invite you to be in community and solidarity with us by making a donation at WPFWFM.org to ensure that this independent grassroots media outlet not only survives, but thrives. It is with your generous support that we build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hey, Chris Garlock here.
And I'm Elise Bryant.
Tune in Thursdays at 1 p.m.
for the Labor Heritage Hour Hour.
Every week, we explore labor arts and culture.
As anarchist Emma Goldman said so famously, if I can't dance, I don't want to be part of your revolution.
And that's how we feel about labor music, films,
theater, poetry,
labor history, labor art,
spoken word. Basically anything that brings labor and the arts together.
So, join us for the Labor Heritage Power Hour
here on WPFW 89.3 FM.
Your station for jazz and justice.
That's the Labor Heritage Power Hour.
Thursdays from 1 to 2 p.m.
The heart and soul.
P.M.
The heart and soul.
Of the American labor movement.